This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Welcome for this evening, which is the last of the Slot exhibitions this year. And I'm very pleased to welcome here Anne-Cécile Guilbard, who is the curator of this show, The Scandals of Hervé Guibert. And tonight, as an introduction to the show itself, we'll have a discussion between Anne-Cécile, Emily Apter, and myself. And I'll introduce both of them, and I'll explain rapidly how we'll proceed. Anne-Cécile will first discuss a number of photographs, and then we'll show the end of Hervé Guibert's film La pudeur et l'impudeur. And then we'll have a short discussion between the three of us, and then we'll open to the questions. So we'll first begin with Anne-Cécile, who will present the work that you will see in the vault later on.
Well, thank you very much, Jean-Michel. I first want to thank you all to be here. Please excuse for advance my accent, and I will make my best to be understandable. So first, I really want to thank you, Jean-Michel Rabaté and Aaron Levy, for the work they allowed me to do here at Slot Foundation. And I'm very honored to be in conversation with Emily, too. So I will read my text in order to be understandable. So let's. I want to introduce some of the photographs I brought from Paris, from Agathe Gaillard's gallery, to Philadelphia today. So a few words about SG's photographic work. I'd say taking pictures is a way of leaving vision aside, of relinquishing an all-controlling vision. Most of the time, a photographer will see the camera as blindfolding his eyes. The body is left free to move or stand in the full presence of space next to others, but to other bodies and objects. SG's photographic work took place at the moment where, in France, photography became a theoretical object. His ghost image in 1981 is now frequently studied as a complement to Camera Lucida by Roland Barthes, which was published in 1980. Even if he did not pretend to propose a theory of photography in it, he offered a collection of stories with pictures in the manner of an album. However, the conception, I mean Barthes and Guibert's, are completely different and show a radical opposite conception of photography. In short, Barthes and Guibert are often at opposite ends. Unlike Barthes, who had theorized photography as the flat death, SG emphasizes the materiality of the pictures by insisting on all the technical problems that can happen with photos, from the picture you have never been able to take to the one you can use to put a spell on someone. Pictures are not only representation, they are singular objects. Photography is considered as a proof. Its specificity will remain as evidence, a faithful imprint of the real, like Parsons Index. Guibert uses it to stage scenes with his friends, undoing any certainty about what really has been. Just when photography was being institutionalized, Guibert assumed an obvious amateur status in photography by taking pictures of his friends. Moreover, instead of working on geometrical compositions, he blows his framings in a way that no viewer can forget that there has been a photographer in front of the scene. The spectator is led to wonder about the circumstances of the pictures. He is thus led to look at the pictures as clues for fiction, to look at the pictures as clues for fictions. In fact, as a photographer as well as a writer, Guibert uses photography to experience stories much more than to keep traces of them. That entails, of course, a dynamic conception of autofiction in the books, which translate into a particular sense of space in his pictures. About the materiality of the pictures, I have to say Hedges is against Balzac's spectral theory. According to Nadar, Balzac believed that each time a photo was taken, a specter was taken off from the sitter's body. Technically, the frame within a frame constitutes a well-known exercise for photographers who are attached to the art of composition. The simplicity of the composition here could evoke Curtis's work. But here, the work on lines within the images goes beyond. The frames ask to be considered as less than geometrical lines, than objects taken in their own materiality. Hedges is not interested in lines over a flat rectangle. His composition is in three dimensions. The family pictures accumulate over a radiator in the grand home's corridor. Among the lines formed by piles of manuscripts, a postcard representing a self-portrait by the young Rembrandt exposes his truculent face and serves to exhibit the artifice of other texts, of a writing which is not less than painting, an art of covering blank paper drawn with figures from the mind. What must be noticed here is, again, the materiality preserved with the image. The image is not simply given as lines gathering over a plan. It is embodied by the position it occupies in the space. The angle Guibert chooses to take the painting of the begging little boy is calculated to confer to the representation the material of the paint that it necessarily implies. The experiences of portraying that Guibert narrates in The Man in the Red Hat with the painter Barcelo, or in his article about Balthus and the legend Guibert forges about the children painted by Balthus, conveys the importance of the body that is involved in painting, the painter's one as well as the model's. The box in the box photo looks like a sign of loneliness, we may think, with 2 feet near the screen showing a porn movie. But here again, the point of view and the way furniture and legs are displayed lead to another sense. The photographer must have stood up to take a picture of this moment that he was sharing with the man who is lying on the couch, watching the porn. Guibert suggests another dimension of the image, the dimension of its material reality. It is no longer a simple surface where spaces and bodies are flattened under a composition of lines. The image is an object that you can seize in your fingers, press against your chest, put into your pocket. Palm tree in fire. This heavy and monstrous trunk is lying, smoke rises, and it thus avoids the obvious symbol of a victorious phallus, offering yet again a way out the dimension of representation. This trunk evokes flesh and blood, but more erotically than symbolically, not yet totally significant, testifying to a moment when things are there to be touched and not to be seen, that is to say, not to be thought yet. Remembering the 20th century photographic tradition of postmortem portraits, Guibert photographs his great aunt Suzanne. One could see there a sort of fascination for death, perfectly approved by numerous well-known theories of the photographic medium. But Guibert plays with these codes. It diverts from the representational codes whose inventory would list a close-up, a profile, and of course the Uncleton deathbed, so as to expose a perfectly fake memento, or to be more precise, an icon faking pleasant memories. If we really want to know everything, 80-year-old Susan present here is staging her own death for the picture. It is a fake. Her nephew made like this a world book of game of this type with her and her younger excellent sister Louise. This says the narrator's desire to take pictures with his grand aunts, whom he visits on Sunday, with a game that they play together, which is an adventure to share between the 20-year-old man and the old ladies. At the same time, John Michaels was working on the similar themes. But as the project finally concerns photography as well as life itself, that is to say, his way of caring for his great aunts, his ordinary life is affected, even motivated, by his photographs. Gina Lollobrigida in Roma is taken in the manner of a photogram extracted from a film in a large view in a crepuscular exterior in the Villa Medici's gardens. Gina embodies cinema in Gibert's work more than anyone. Other texts of his display her among shields and aquariums, like various forms of screens that separate the movie idol, a woman turned into image, from the spectator who Gibert is. Very interestingly indeed, in his texts, like in the pictures he takes, SG refuses any intimacy with the Italian star, and he frames her just like the picture she truly, unresistingly is. The friends lead to the crucial point with a feeling of incredulity or even suspicion that it commands. This is a true hospital room, but how far can we believe that the handsome, Christ-like young man lying in the bed is a real patient? The man who assists him on the left affects the careful attitude which would remind of an ancient painting of women at the foot of the cross in crucifixion scenes. The light above the bed, its centrality, and the strong contrast it brings to the naked arms on the white sheets, the suffering man's long hair and his nudity, even the regularity of his features, bring about an impression of déjà vu by reference to some cultural image. The image of suffering seems paradoxically too referenced, and maybe too well composed, to be true. And the feeling of suspicion of fake pain, fake patient, is precisely what has contaminated Gibert's entire work since his first book, La Mort Propagande. A fake death, a real movie star, these are undecidable scenes that HG creates with his camera, deconstructing the evidence against the so-called objectivity of the image. He meets here what Gisèle Freund describes in Photography and Society. The objectivity of the picture is nothing but an illusion, she wrote. The captions that comment on it can completely change its meaning. Unquote. But moreover, the confusing strengths of his pictures are partly to do with the way Gibert stages scenes that may happen. Susan's death, for instance. He seems to be rehearsing the future so as to get prepared to it, as if he wanted to avoid its fate by acting before having to live the same scenes in real. This is quite the same trick that he will use in the video La Pudeur ou l'Impudeur. There he's acting his own death. I am thinking of the suicide scene, we may see, making a fiction of what will really happen. Gibert's friends are his models. Whether they are famous or not, they join in the same way the Gibertian novel and find themselves in the photographic album as well. T. Thierry and Eugène's beauty, this is Eugène, of course, inspires the search of the beautiful pictures that agrees with their absolute physical perfection. Eugène has the delicateness of the small bunch of roses he holds in his hand. He stands just naked, and his body shares the background between light and shade. He looks like Orpheus, bringing back from hell the only memory that he could keep from Eurydice. When he has his son Marin, Eugène will write about these small beautiful things that a child can see, hear, and taste. Thierry is Hervé's everlasting love, the one who had access to the Rita's diary from the beginning to the end. They were 17 when they met. Thierry died 7 months after Hervé. The picture strikes by its academism. The pose is classical, and he faces the photographer in the regular distance for a full-length portrait. He occupies the middle of the picture, the light is a calibrated, and comes from a slight opening of a curtain on the right. The full-length portrait is a heritage of classical painting whose purpose was to immortalize the model's image. Benjamin's Little History of Photography refers to this heritage as a symbol of the increasing bourgeoisie in the beginning of the 19th century. Here, Guibert uses the codes of this kind of photography for an intimate deviation. The posture is classical, as well as the composition and the light. The breach with the suggested academism comes, of course, from the model's clothes and the way he holds his head inclined. The set lightened in the background allows one to distinguish the details of an uncluttered bed. These details are like an anomaly which invalidates the stereotype that the picture was evoking. Thierry does not sit for some anonymous photographer. The expression of consent he has in his look shows enough that he poses for his lover. Thus, this picture fails to be the classical eternal portrait it could have been, so as to enhance the moment that the photographer and the model shared. Thierry's look reintroduces the photographer into the photographic scene. The latter is not the anonymous witness he ought to be. His presence resists within the picture, betrayed by the model's expression of love. Instead of a portrait, this appears as a clue for a story between the photographer and the model. This story belongs to the Gubertian novel. The comedian Zouk's portrait is a very difficult picture to look at. The white towels for the one who used to be dressed in black translates the medical gaze and evokes madness, psychological disease. She turns her back, faces the wall, expressing her refusal to be photographed. But she does not leave the scene. This is the portrait of the shame to be seen, picturing the disgrace, the embarrassment. This is the failure of a portrait which is photographed here. She has left the white towels down. The frame reveals the white background and masks the stage. She chooses another pose, an insane pose for a portrait. This picture of an abandoned portrait tells more intimately than the previous one who she is. The work on framing is very important in SG's work because it has to say amateurism when we could expect professionalism. By bungling his framing, Guibert assumes, I think he claims, the only truth in photography, which resides in the registration of the encounter between the photographer and the photographed. This is what Barthes had finally found with the punctum of photography that has been. But the theorist had eluded the photographer's question during his investigation. In fact, he had got rid of it. since Bard focused his attention on the spectator's point of view. This is precisely what Gilbert manages to avoid with his framings. The misframing prevents the picture from falling into some anonymous point of view. Michel's portrait is the precise example of this. The picture could have been a wonderful icon of Foucault, with the multiple reflections of his silhouette over the black lacquered doors. Symbolically, the diffraction of the shadow could have probably made one of the greatest portraits of the philosopher ever taken. But the slight shifting towards the top of the picture crops his feet and, once more, unmasks the decor, the set. Thus, this is Michel who appears, and not Foucault. The doors reveal what they are, doors leading to other rooms of a Parisian apartment. And the question that arises concerns who could have taken this picture of the philosopher at home in his home suit. Indeed, Agé was his neighbor and close friend. So, defective framings have the function of recalling the photographer within the picture. They prevent him from his necessary disappearance while he is to be replaced by the spectator. We may say that there are, in the self-portrait genre, two kinds of photographers. The ones who keep control over the image as a result of not leaving the camera away from their eyes. Let's say, for instance, Liefried Lenders. And all the others. Hervé Guibert belongs to this latter, who partly abandon control over their image by taking the picture with the camera in the end, directed as much as possible towards its target. He does not see what the camera will take. He thus let happen the image of the self, just like one can test a chemical experience. Even if he pictures himself in the mirror and seems to control his expression perfectly, he makes himself unable to expect the picture that will result, the framing once more, but also his own gaze, anamorphosized by the optical axis modification. Experimenting is always more important than leaving traces in Gilbert's photographic work. That can also explain his singular mode of writing. The result provided by the tests he makes will never match reality. Maybe this is a question of point of view, and we should pay attention to the slight shifting of the camera distracted from the eye to understand how a man who pictures himself so systematically comes out blind in the picture. The Only Face, this is the title, finally concerns the entire work, not only by Gilbert's choice to depict only what looks at him, what touches him, but also by the way he structures the picture. He tells about it in the preface of his photograph album and traces the difference between his way to photograph and Cartier-Bresson's one. The great photographer was interested in an adjustment of lines while Gilbert wanted to get closer to a face. In technical terms, we could say that Cartier-Bresson structures his pictures vertically, like a painter does it in front of a landscape, whereas Gilbert composes them horizontally, like a walking man who gets ready to get in.
We just cut before a moment when he seems to disappear. Oh, this was a film that he had shot himself or with friends with a little video camera. And at the end, you just see the typewriter apparently typing by itself. But maybe you can explain a little more what is at stake in the suicide or...
Yes, the suicide scene is very, very interested, very interesting when he, when we can see him turning those two glasses. There is one. I don't know if you have understood the text. There is one containing the 17, the 17 drops.
70 drops, yeah.
70 drops of digitaline, which is the, which is poison, and this is the well, this is the poison, and he seems to be playing with luck or hazard during this scene. In fact, in his diary, which was published after his death, 10 years after his death, he says that he had a little sign to see which one was the real poisonous glass and which one was wasn't. But he also says that during the time while he was turning, he hesitated and maybe he had risked an accident. And what's very interesting in it is, as I try to show, fiction, he stages all the time. He stages photographers, he stages in his novel, he stages himself, he stages his clothes. And in this scene, what is funny is that he really nearly died with an accident of fiction, in fact. So just as if fiction had taking the power over his real life. So this is a very, very precise scene about which is very representative of all the Gilbert's work, of all the way of his enterprise, in fact.
And maybe we can come back to this if you have questions, but we wanted to show the second half or the ending of that film rather than the beginning, that is much more a documentation of the degradation of his body from AIDS, to show that today if we watch it, this film doesn't trigger the same general unease or topical reaction of a knee-jerk or another film about AIDS, and appears much more as a relatively beautiful aesthetic and so on, despite the sort of bad camera and the shaky hand and so on, plus a very constructed story, as it were. And maybe this could be the opportunity for Emily to go back to something like the reception or the general context of Guibert.
First, let me just say I'm very grateful to Anne-Cécile for bringing this exhibition here and putting it together, and for your eloquent remarks, because, you know, in a sense I stand between these last two remarks, in that Guibert is primarily known as, in the U.S. or in North America, in the Anglophone context, as France's AIDS writer, one of his premier writers about AIDS, and his photographic work and the fact that he was a photographer for Le Monde from 1977 and wrote hundreds of articles, this is not very well appreciated in the English-speaking context. It's much less known, so this is a very special opportunity, and I just wanted to underscore that. What I have are some thoughts, questions that are not completely continuous, and some of them I've picked out because they respond more closely to remarks that you've made. And I'll just go through a few of those, but it's not a paper, it's by way of opening up things for discussion among us and with the audience. So just a few things. I first encountered his work when, in around 1990, Guibert was born in 55 and died in 91. And this was before anything was translated into English, or maybe there were a few things, but he was not well known in the Anglophone context. And he fascinated me. It was a friend of mine who had worked on Barthes who signaled his work to me, Philippe Roger. And it soon became clear that this fascinating book, Al'ami qui ne m'a pas sauvé la vie, to this friend who did not save my life, which was this book about Foucault coded under the name Musil, which caused a lot of controversy because people at the time in France didn't want him to, they felt that he'd sort of violated certain secrets about Foucault in writing about him and in writing about him when he was dying. But I mention this because you have to sort of understand that Guibert is very situated in the French scene. Even though he's not a theorist, I would put him in, first of all, with literary figures, big influences on him, Georges Bataille, Jean Genet, especially in an early work, La Mort Propagande, which was one of his first publications in 1977. Michel Tournier, Guy Aucunem, and another very little-known writer who's extremely strange and violent and bizarre and very interesting to compare with the more sadomasochistic phantasms in Guibert's work was Pierre Guillotat. And I would also mention, in terms of this string of writers, Renaud Camus and Cyril Collard. And then on the theoretical side, Barthes and Foucault are the most important in his life. He went to Barthes' seminars, was disappointed by the content of the lecture, was not attracted to Barthes, and yet was immensely influenced, as Anne-Cécile mentioned, by many of his writings. Although when one reads one of his most important works, The Phantom Images, or Phantom Image, L'Image Fantôme, you think, oh, he's influenced by La Chambre Claire, by Camera Lucida of Barthes. But in fact, these works came out at the same time. We have to remember that he's really making his own very important contribution to how to write photography, not as an expert, not as somebody who comes at it with technical insider's knowledge, but really more as somebody who is searching for to make photography its own kind of discourse. And so it's interesting to read these two works side by side, the Barthes and the Phantom Images of Guibert. He was diagnosed as seropositive in 88, and it's interesting, we can come back to this later, but I think in some ways his work in its exploration, just as he's exploring languages of writing about photography, he's also exploring in a kind of pioneering way, how to write AIDS. There's very early in his life, in this La Mort Propagande, 1977, he has this kind of strange hymn paean to syphilis, and he has this image of group sex, and even launches the imperative, infectons-les, let's infect them, let's have this kind of solidarity of those who are ill. And this is in 1977, and it's as if there's something very bizarre and quite consistent in his work, which is that he kind of almost writes in a programmatic way or scripts some things that he will return to later as formulas for writing about being ill later on, that he has a kind of fascination with writing about sex that's quite anatomical and quite medical. He takes the camera and he explores his anus and he documents his excrements. And this is in the early 70s. He's very interested in turning the inside out and in exploring jouissance or pleasure in this almost scientific way. And I think the choice of his term in another famous work, which is Le Protocole Compassionnel, which is translated Compassion Protocol. The idea of the protocol as both in that kind of bureaucratic and medical and institutional sense, the detailed record of the procedure, there's something already in his very earliest writings that is exploring scientific procedures applied to eroticism, and that's, in fact, his term for it. He describes it in that way. So there is this very interesting way in which he's kind of coming up with protocols for writing about sex in very unusual ways. The other things I would that I wanted to mention. Just before I forget the Barthes, and I just wanted to, as a kind of footnote, with the comparison with Barthes. Barthes, as you remember, in La Chambre Claire, the kind of punctum example is when he encounters, after his mother's death, the image of his mother in the winter garden, and he kind of fixates on that. Guibert has a similar scene. The first chapter of the Phantom Images is he goes through an elaborate procedure with his mother. He says, "I don't like your hair. I'm going to wash it, make it straight. I'm going to dress you the way I want you to be seen." And he photographs her. And then it's blank. He fails technically. And so, in a sense, you have this kind of memorial to his mother, which is the image that did not work, the blank, compared to the sort of image of Barthes' mother, which he doesn't include in the book, but it's also a kind of photograph through words. So there's that very interesting image of, and some of what of your remarks made me think more about this, because you emphasized spectrality and theatricality and spiritualism, almost the kind of staging effect. There's something very staged about absence and shadows, and where there are some fantastic ones where he has his own hand holding the camera that appears, or where there are what we would call almost technical accidents that become absolutely crucial. And they're brought out, I think, also by the fact that, as you see here even, so many of the settings are blank apartments, right? They even in the first half of the film, it's all in for understandable reasons, but everything is interior. There's very little. You get on the airplane at one point, but there's very little outside world. It's a world of friends, of networks, but also of these blank walls and shadows and refractions. And there's something about being in a kind of room with him that's both claustrophobic and intimate, impersonal and intimate. And I think that's also something that is very consistently part of his aesthetic. There's also something very actual about it, because his writing, he's, as Anne-Cécile mentioned, is experimenting with autofiction, self-writing. And that's something that's grown and grown in interest in terms of the shift from the great. You have to remember that he's writing in the era of structuralism and post-structuralism, where the death of the author is extremely important. And there's a real turning away in the 70s from biography. And so one of the things that fascinates me about Guibert's writing is that it's a kind of structuralist autobiography. It retains a certain impersonality, and yet it's absolutely in real time and very, very referential to details about his life. So it's an interesting kind of autofiction. And at the same time, it aroused quite a bit of resistance in France, just as his explicit writings about gay sex was considered. The French tended to either put it into a pre-existing set of codes and conventions, like, oh, that's sod, or that's jeunet, or that's bataille. So he's doing that, rather than saying that he's actually traversing some other kind of boundary. But the question then of in a sense, what was most controversial was the fact that he's using his friends, that he's writing personally. That is a big no-no, I think. Just as talking about your illness in France, there's still more of a code, I think, of reticence, and it's like not done. It depends on what milieu you're in, I would say, the U.S. culture, too, but I think there's a certain resistance to what would be considered a kind of self-indulgence or confessionalism, that unless it enters into a tradition of confessional writing from Augustine to Rousseau, you know, he crosses the line. He got a lot of people angry at him. So there's something very interesting. But then also Anne-Cécile mentioned that he's also staging. So another thing that aroused anger was the fact that people said, it's not true what he said. You know, having been set himself up as the writer who crossed the line of verite, he lied. It wasn't like that. So he kind of gets it from both sides in the reception. There's also something very 70s, 80s about, even though you have these blank interiors, you don't have a lot of periodization. It's not period rooms or anything. But I think there, in its very blankness, to me, there's something quite poignant about a certain sensibility of the 70s. It's casual. It's between sort of Duane Michaels and Mapplethorpe, the use of the figure and the blank wall. And so there's a kind of writing without style or photography without style that is nonetheless a style that is so... He captures this, and I was struck by, there's a nice book by Ralph Sarkanak. It's called Angelic Echoes, H.G. and Company. And he describes, Sarkanak says, I come to Guibert sort of falling in love with his beauty. And then he looks at a photograph of Thierry, and he says, and this is, gets back to my point about the timing or the periodization. He says, looking at T, I'm transported. His body is a very 70s body. They just don't seem to make men like that anymore. For nowadays, men come complete with muscles, but hardly any hair. Looking at T, I'm transported back to the Toronto of the 70s and all the long-haired boys who used to amble along Yonge Street on their colorful high-heeled shoes, wearing tight little leather jackets. In the photo of T, unlike the bodies displayed in today's skin magazines and many of Robert Mapplethorpe's photos, the sensuality is not lodged in the rock-hard flesh beneath the skin. Rather, the sensuality is located in the touch and feel of the body's outer envelope. Fittingly enough for the period, it is a structuralist sensuality based on the notion of a tactile, even textual difference, as in the Bartesian body. So I was very struck by the kind of periodization that is captured here. And I'm just going to end by alluding to something which I think is very interesting about how Guibert is always in company or with friends. I think that the photographs, in a sense, they're not traces in this kind of Derridean sense of traces, but there is something about how you give yourself as a gift or accept something else. And again, just to end on this idea of how he creates a vocabulary for something that will come later in this kind of predictive or premonitory way. He wrote this little text in 1979 called La Piqûre d'Amour, the love injection. And there's something about the whole idea of gifting or sharing the practice of gifting now, which is to take the virus and share it among friends, needle sharing. There's a whole idea about sharing death, which I think is announced very early on in his work. And this is something kind of uncanny about him. He's constantly coming up with words for procedures or cultural practices or forms of eroticism that will, in a way, come to happen later on. And when you talked about the rehearsal of the future, that seemed to me very apropos. So I'll stop there. But
thank you very much, Emily. And indeed, I think what we can see today is how complex and hard to analyze his work is. And I think this is why it was important to show a few photographs, even though he made many more, because it looks as if, seen from today's perspective, we had three Guiberts, in a way, the photographer and the writer about photography and the later Guibert, who is a little better known in this country because of the revelations about Foucault, the confessional Guibert writing about AIDS, and that documentary about himself. And he's not the only one. Ockenham is another important example of an activist, a gay activist, also died of AIDS, and who is close to him in sensibility. And then there's the earlier Guibert, who personally, I have to say, as a reader, It was that Guibert that I first met. My parents, was a total scandal when it was published in 1986, before there was any, and before he was diagnosed or was there any talk of AIDS. And it's a vitriolic account of being a son of totally average parents, but destroyed, debunked. The désaveugle of the blind is a very ferocious Baroque description of the blind, the world of the blind. It's a magnificent book, superbly written. But Guibert never repeated himself, and it's something I forget where he wrote it. He explained that he had, at the end of his life, caught two viruses, the virus of AIDS and the virus of Thomas Bernhardt.
Yeah.
And Thomas Bernhardt was even worse than AIDS, because then he wrote one or two books like Thomas Bernhardt. And I think we've seen this very well in what Anne-Cécile and Emily have shown, that he was somebody who seemed somehow to have caught that zeitgeist a little before it was there, anticipating always and trying out other things. And then remains the question of where does photography or photographing as a practice stand there? Is it part of his first job? As you have heard, very young, Guibert was the critic at Le Monde, and he would cover photographs. And at the time when it was not so, let's say, common to have that in France. And he wrote thousands of reviews, literally. Some of these have been collected. And, of course, the ghost image, l'image fantôme, is the first collection. And by certain aspects, it's sort of an anti-camera lucida, clearly, deliberately or not, I'm not sure. But then, what is the role of photography? And I'd say that, at least maybe we see this here, photography is like writing for him. That's what I would like to suggest. And it is a certain way of writing that is by other means, you might say, and writing about oneself, staging and writing the truth, as it were, questioning issues like what is beautiful, what is sexy, what is desire, and what is the body, which are his main themes. And I was therefore wondering whether he was really taken seriously enough today as a photographer. I don't think he is, and that's a question for perhaps both of you. Should one take him seriously as a photographer, or should one try to see Hervé Guibert as a sort of phenomenon, the myth that he tried to create? Unhappily, I'd say, for him and for everybody, because of AIDS, and he achieved somehow what he wanted to get, that is universal recognition, and he died of it, but maybe for the wrong reasons. At least that's the question I would have for you.
Well, about the if he's a photographer or a writer, this is the question. In fact, it's funny because when you ask some people who are especially interested in photography and who know his work, they always say, "Of course, he's a great photographer." And if you ask some literary people if he's a great writer, of course he's a writer. So it depends whom you ask, in fact. But actually, I truly agree with you when you say it's kind of writing. I mean, it's Wall Enterprise. I think he led by his work in his photographic work and his literary work and his video work. This experiment thing, you know. Just like in you were talking about scientific vocabulary. Yes, he used to write just like a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a physician who is looking at the body of his patient. He was taught to be writing like this. And the look, the gaze, the way he looks at things, it seems the most important thing in his work, as well as in the photographic work and in the literary work. Mm. It's a question of point of view, I think so. Mm-hmm. Mm. And because of the distance he has, how he settles, it can't, reality or fiction is not a difference which can matter anymore. It's not efficient anymore because of this distance.
Mm-hmm. And I see perhaps, I don't know whether you would agree with this, that, when we had given this title, The Scandals, I guess people may have expected something really hardcore. I have to say, it's not. I hope, some of you will just run out of the self-slot now. But no, it's much less scandalous, at least in terms of the image, what you see in the images and even in the documentary, than what he writes. But for me, when he writes, I see him as an heir to Sade, Marquis de Sade, and in the most scandalous, the most baroque and violent book, Vous m'avez fait former des fantômes, you forced me to imagine ghosts, but it's really, maybe you want to describe the plot. I mean, it's a man who captured children, mutilated them, transform them into, say, animals, and then have corridas with them, sexual corridas, but the children die. It's really a very difficult novel to read. Of course, he never filmed anything like that, as far as I know. So, like Sade, I think Guibert had this impression, everything can be said. You can say everything. Thus, he can look at family albums, look at his own father and say, well, when he was 20, he was a good-looking man. I could have had sex with him. at the same time, accuse his father of having wiped his bum when he was 13 years old and things like that. So playing with very, very different strategies, but with this possibility of a total freedom, which perhaps is more difficult to find with the medium of photography today, or at this time. But I think this is, for me, the constant of Guibert, that you have to try out everything. You shouldn't be the slave of any morality. You shouldn't be respectful. Even Barthes is boring and not sexy, but nevertheless a master. The totally anti-respectful attitude facing all authorities and so on. Even Foucault, who was a friend, Foucault is really put at a certain distance. And I wonder where this irreverence comes from.
I would just say one thing that, again, I think that to second what you're saying about the experimentalism, but I think probably writing disease was more controversial than writing sex.
Right.
But that they're not disconnected for him in any way, and that there's a famous scene where he's having an internal, I guess it's a kind of endoscopy, a fibro-optic test, and it's described as a kind of rape, oral rape. So the languages of sex and protocols, medical protocols, are commensurable and reciprocal. But the other thing that, he says at one point, AZT makes me write one way, DDI makes me write another, that he's actually saying that the drugs that keep me alive as a process also have their own writing mode. And it made me think of Judith Butler's question about what would gender call itself outside the feminine and the masculine. And it's like, what would Sida call itself? How would it write itself? It's a kind of opening in question of the question. And the drugs are part of that equation. And I think that links in interesting ways to this staged but not so staged suicide attempt, and even the fact that, as far as I recall, he in fact did die because of after a suicide attempt, not because he succeeded.
Right.
But so I mean, I think that you mentioned that, but the whole question also of dosages, dose and timing, the timing of a life. And how even the idea of his sentence structure, the rhythm, the metrics of dosage is somehow part of the way a drug will help him write his way into writing disease. I think that's something interesting to think about. And finally, I was just going to mention that there's one of the last works he did is called Cytomegalovirus, which is a journal of his treatment at the very end of his life. And there, too, it's like he's experimenting with, in a way, the megalomania of the disease, you know. And this is something, of course, he himself was accused of being narcissistic and
right.
megalomaniac. And so I don't think they're separate. I think he's always problematizing these very things, mm-hmm. and that's part of what makes it interesting.
I think we had decided not to speak more than 1 hour, so we can open to questions from the audience. We can go on after asking questions one another, but please, if you have anything to say, either about what we have said or the documentary, you are welcome. Yes.
Thank you for your thoughts. I was wondering if you could reflect a little bit on perhaps the points of contact that his work had with a series of other writers that were epochally linked as well. And I'm thinking of Scott Tucker in the U.S., as well as Ignacio Arenas, who actually happened upon his work and in an interview talked about how it reminded him of Achier's photography, especially those scenes that conjure crime, because one is left with the need then to sort of establish motivation as well as a course of action after crime has been committed. So I see a series of parallels here that were forged as a result of a lot of AIDS writers who were coming up with a new type of writing during the crisis, and I was wondering if you're familiar with either the two writers' work and artists' work, or if you saw any other points of contact with similar writers here in the U.S.
I don't know if I can really answer that. I'm more struck by the lack of points of contact. I mean, I'd like to sort of fit Guibert more into an international network, and maybe there's more than I'm aware of, but at the time he was writing, you know, the big point of comparison was Paul Monnet and the sentimentality, right? And that was the counter discourse to this, and it was considered so different. So I guess what struck me when I was initially encountering his work was how there was absolutely, you know, not an obvious place of reception for this kind of writing about AIDS. More the differences than the parallels. But then, of course, you know, it depends which point of, in quote, literary history you're looking. So.
I don't know whether you would agree. Yeah, I see him as very French in a sense, in the French lineage. He mentioned Severo Sarduy, but he was a Parisian in a way, in a sense. But he often mentions Genet and Bataille as the two, and Guyotat, close to Guyotat. I'm not sure whether Guyotat is very well known in this country, but
just starting, mm-hmm.
Yeah. So he was, of course, somebody who had traveled, I think, a lot, and so he had come to the U.S. and so on. But I don't have the impression, maybe you will say it differently, that he read the American novelists?
Oh, wait, he does mention Melville and Poe.
Melville and Poe, absolutely. The classical.
But not the AIDS work.
That's it, but the contemporary. contemporary writers?
He doesn't mention any further name in the in his text. He often speaks about classical texts, just as Don Quixote, or but for the contemporary, they are French. Yes, they are Barthes, his friend Foucault, of course. He is very deeply read. Mm. In fact, he was really influenced. If there is an influence, we may find it in Paris. I'm afraid, yes, but. That's also an interesting part, because we haven't talked about this this point, but Foucault's influence, Foucault's theory, Foucault's philosophy's influence in Gilbert's novel is very sensitive, sensible in his novels. So this is another another aspect of.
Well, I think what you said about Adjé is very interesting and quite true. I don't know how he does it, but a number of his photographs have an Adjé-like feel to it, and I don't know how to account for that.
My understanding is not so. yes, he knew very, very well the photography of Adjé. Yes, of course. He wrote at least, I have in mind, two articles about. But when he was here, when Berenice Abbott took Adjé's work out of the knowledge, so he knew very well. About the photography, is very aware of everything because of his job. I mean, from 77, you mentioned it, from 77 to 85, He opened. He was the one who opened the photography critic in Le Monde. There wasn't any kind of this column frequently in the newspaper. So yes, about photography, this is absolutely right. He knew it, and we can find many influences. Yes, of course.
And what occurs to me is the fact that I came to his work by virtue of a Cuban American writer. Dying of AIDS, his document and his own trajectory could have inspired his work. So this is another curious aspect that really I think is ripe for development and research too.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Any other questions?
Aaron has
one. My knowledge of you there is more limited to this project that I've been working on. I agree that there's this experimental disposition, and it's one that's more marked by, say, a certain irreverence. At the same time, from the images that we've seen in the video, I don't see a pataphysical kind of humor. I see an irreverence, but not one that's humorous in this sense. It seems, at least in these portraits, to be marked by a seriousness and a melancholy. Mm-hmm. Is the humor there, but just maybe not visible in these images?
That's really your question, but I'll just make one quick remark about it. I agree with you. I think that, that leads you into the question of staging. As I mentioned, there's one with this kind of Hitchcockian goth or macabre. There's a whole taxidermy and museal. Fascination, collecting objects. So whether there's a kind of fascination with morbidity and dead objects and fetishes, and yet there's something so mawkish about it. You almost think, oh, he's doing the Edgar Allan Poe thing. You know, there is. So I wouldn't just slot it into melancholia. Although I think the images in this that were selected here have more of that. Than humor, certainly, but
yeah. There is some humor. Often when he's cruel, I think about the diary you mentioned, Cytomegalovirus. It's a hospitalization diary, so it should be terribly awful and sad. And I remember the first time I read it, I was in a cafe, and I laughed. I mean, I laughed highly because it was so, the positions he was in and the way he was talking about, telling about the medical aspects, and he was stuck into his chair and waiting for a nurse that he claimed for the third time, but he was paranoid and maybe, well, these are so many moments like this when he can be very funny, in fact. Funny with himself. Maybe, yes, in the video it's not, well, I think it's not obvious, but it has to do.
It's interesting that you have done this thesis with Guibert and Beckett, and at first I was thinking, but you know, there's an interview with him with Patrick Darbor on Ex Libris, one of these book talk shows, a bit like Apostrophe, and the uniform he invents for himself is like Gogo. He wears always a kind of chaplain-esque or hat and a big jacket, you know, and there's something almost Beckettian.
He's a skeleton wearing
a
par-dessus, just like in
Descartes. But it is almost a kind of vaudevillian.
But I think it's a good question, because I agree that humor is not so easy to find, although many of the books or of the photographs can be funny. But humor in general, at least this is the Freudian definition, presupposes the superego. And Guibert did everything he could to get rid of his superego. He didn't have a superego, not a very strong superego on principle. And it's more a structural humor. That is that very often it's about reversals or trying to see and describe as blandly as one can, and then something happens. Little like Tommy again, you know, Sad's humor, which is very, very important, when Sad writes to his wife, "Oh, my darling, you're asking for my underwear. I know that you're going to have a lot of fun with my underwear," which was, in fact, she was just asking to wash his underwear where he'd been at La Bastille for 3 months, and so on. That kind of humor you would find with Guibert. It's not...
I think it has to do with the sincerity. I mean, sometimes with the freedom he has. He talks... he's so truly... funny. I'm thinking of the novel Blind, Des Aveugles, which it could be terrible this time again. But because it's about three blind people in an institution, so in their life, and in fact there is a lover, a husband, and a wife, and there will be a murder. So it's turned into something very documentary. Very interesting in a documentary point of view about blind people and the way they can't see, and it's funny because he doesn't he doesn't have pity for anything.
That's it.
And even it's for the la pudeur ou l'impudeur. I mean, when he's in the toilets. We've seen it once, but in the montage made by Maureen Mazurek, we see this scene many, many times. I think it could be, it could have been finally, not funny, but another word.
Yeah. But for instance, since you mentioned Des Aveugles, there was a theatrical production adapting the novel, and Guibert was not in it, but he had participated in the adaptation, and he had insisted. So in the story, you have someone who is a little like Guibert, who would read to blind people in institutions like that. And the actor, who is supposed to be the only person who can see, was in fact a blind actor. But you wouldn't see it because he would just walk exactly normally. But in fact, it was part of the little jokes that everybody else who was supposed to be blind as a character could see, except that for this person who was blind. Is that funny? Not necessarily. But there's a certain grating sense of discrepancy here that I think he would enjoy. Any other questions about maybe the things that were not so obvious in the documentary about this strange pact with the suicide, as I think we've seen, the suicide attempt is then a failure, and then he says that he can live differently, but it's not clear whether he's not going to die again and by drowning that attempt as well. And I was thinking of a scene that perhaps been influenced by it. Some of you may have seen in Chantal Akerman's adaptation of Proust, where you have a very similar shot, and La Captive, where at the end the person who is supposed to be Albertine for Proust dies or is killed by the lover. So there's also this ambivalence facing survival, suicide, and so on. Yes.
It's also that, apparently he did have this kind of play roulette with poison,
right.
And there's this, again, a kind of controlling of risk and then letting risk control you, which in a way is to untime a life. I think that a lot of this is about survival, but you can't, no one survives, so the question is the term of life.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all the staging of beyond death, which is, in some ways, recalls the occult and these kind of funny spirit sessions of seances and channeling and contacting spirits. There's something almost funny about the allusion to that 19th century tradition of spiritualism.
Mm.
But I think there's also something to do with reprogramming the life sequence and you know, staging your own death and then waking up. It's both very manipulative because you as an audience are thinking, am I going to watch this guy die? And then he does the same thing with his great aunt or his aunt. You know, he makes her act out her death, and then it's, and she's a kind of Grey Gardens type anyway. And then, whoops, no, she survived, and it's all staged. But then you start to get into the logic of that staging.
Yeah, you know, I mean, one could... He's the opposite of someone like Mishima, who wrote about his suicide and then acted it in a very dramatic manner. I mean, he's similar in the sense that he did indeed commit suicide, being, you know, close to death anyway. But he wanted, I think, to undo the pathos of that kind of gesture. So this is why it has to be a strange game. And it was interesting to learn that he played it with himself, vaguely, you know, setting a certain rule and then bypassing it. So as if to leaving to chance something like the possibility of dying or not.
Do you take the diary
interested in the idea of planting, the idea that he planted the seeds of the diary. Can you understand it with English?
Do
you accept his diaries?
As a
documentary?
Exactly. No, that's a good question.
That's a really good question, because Thierry had access to it. So this time again, is it truly intimate? And I would say I don't, but I would say further than that. I don't care. In fact. No, that's what Guibert, for me, brought, which is very, very important. I mean, for life, of course, well, but also for literature. And I mean, it's one of the most important points. Because you were talking about Vous m'avez fait former des fantômes. I always remember about this text, the article Raymond Bellour had written in France, that his title was To Dare Imagine. And this is the truth, just like in Mes Parents. Who cares if Guibert hated or not truly his parents? When he writes, I would like them to be dead. Is it true or not? This is not the importance. What's important is to dare telling what you think. It's going wrong. In fact, in this frontier between what's true, what's document, what's fiction. Is what he managed to make full, and this is the uncertainty, this undecidable, with this blurred frontier, which is circulating in. This is the most important thing, I think so. Yes.
Mm-hmm. I think the violence is also in the fake. You know, it's something, there's a whole book in French, it doesn't work in English, unhappily, on photo, like fake photograph, because the faux is already in photo. So a whole book about bad photographs, deliberately bad photographs, bad photographers, missed photographs, bungled things, you know, and as often more interesting, in a sense. Perhaps, I don't know whether you would agree with this, but you see this in Guibert, that often he doesn't recrop or redo something that he could easily do. I'm not sure why, whether it's a sort of game with himself, or it's like that, it's a gesture, the Zen thing, or I think it's an interesting accident and one should leave a trace of the accident.
But also that he plays with the aesthetic and not. I mean, he, as you've said, he's a kind of classical French writer in some ways.
Yep.
Even the, you know, it's not like it's in with Guillotat. It's almost like reading Joyce. You know, you have to really struggle with syntax or with the vocabulary. And with him, it's a piece of cake to read it. I mean, it's very smooth and. But so there's an aesthetic seduction and pleasingness.
No, I understand. I think the one thing he truly does redo is his diary on every level. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing he does.
You mean redo as in a genre from the beginning?
Okay. He writes the diary, he types it, he's changing what he's writing as he's typing it over. He redoes the diary by taking things out of the diary and making fictions of them. So I do think that actually that's not true. That is the one thing that he does on every level.
More than the autofiction?
Or
the
I think so. Because I think the diary becomes the fiction, what puts in the fiction, with the diary thing determines what thing goes. And it's like grafting a plant, but which is what's so fascinating about the taking one thing from one medium, playing it in another, what grows, what happens when you put it back. I don't think that there's anything that's accidental, or that's like, document in the diary. That's what is actually the problem.
But I think what both of you are saying is that it's he's exposing the desire for it to be true, which we've seen in cases like James Fry. I mean, people get really invested in memoirs and diaries being true. So that's the controversial bit here.
Mm-hmm. I'd say the diary is a plan of and an observation of something he plans, he stages. So yes, the diary is the source of everything. But what happened to him in the real life was planned before. So you maybe know in the Compassion Protocol this sentence. I was looking for how do you say in English positions, narrative positions who are dangerous for me. I was looking for narrative positions who are dangerous for me. That's incredible, because this is the point. In life, he was acting just like a character. So, in his diary, it could be true. everything was fiction.
It's fictional.
So this is why the society is so impressive.
Yes.
I don't know anything except for the Désaveugle. Did he do a lot?
Yes, he wrote. Actually, he wrote
yes.
A dramatic work, which was played in Avignon. And in fact, he wanted to write and to the staging thing is at the beginning of his desire of writing. But it quickly turned into the cinema desire, which is the matter he speaks about much, very much in his in his work. And I think it's the possibility of rehearsing, retourner la scène, répéter avant. To rehearse the scene with...
That's Shani, I didn't recognize you without your glasses. he co-wrote the screenplay for L'Homme Blessé with Patrice Chéreau.
Yeah, he was a friend of Chéreau. Who marked the whole generation in France, really, Chéreau, the Chéreau years. It's hard to give an equivalent, but Chéreau really transformed the idea of the stage, I would say, since the late 70s. So even though it's with a film.
That was performed as a play, I think, after it was a film. I know I've seen it on this advertised as a play.
It was a play first?
No, I think the opposite. I think it was performed as a play after it was a film.
L'Homme Blessé?
L'Homme Blessé, no?
It's never been a film.
No, not, but I think there was a stage version.
Of L'Homme Blessé, maybe.
I didn't know, okay.
I think I saw that in...
It was a successful film, yeah.
Not a big thing, but it was like a small theatrical version of the...
What's interesting about this L'Homme Blessé too is, this is the title of a painting by Courbet, Gustave Courbet, and it's a self-portrait of Courbet. And the story of this portrait is the... at the beginning he was just wanted to make a portrait of him and his young bride or fiancée, and they got separated during the time he was painting, so he finally erased his fiancée and put a wand on his on his chest, just as he was wounded, but it was formerly It should have been a portrait of a sieste,
a nap
with his fiancée. So that's very interesting about the staging thing, the faking things, because, Guibert found the title, and it wasn't Chéreau.
And also the prevalence of the curtains.
Right, exactly. Right. Right.
It's not just a reflection about what is fake or is not fake. We are in the middle of this crazy tragedy of Virginia Tech, and it seems that everyone is trying to say that if we had stood these writings from the Yankee, we would have avoided that. It's just a reflection about what is fake, if I don't care, but no, it seems that they are building the case, all week we're supposed to understand if somebody writes something so violent, and we have to be careful, etc., etc. So, but my question is another one, which I could think about in this paper, for example. What you said before, he said that he is a photographer, a writer, or he writes a book. Has he ever written anything about photography?
Yes.
Does his split you did? Explain his photography to writings.
But himself as a photographer?
Yes, he in Ghost Images, the Ghost Image, the Phantom Image, I don't know how it's translated.
Ghost Image?
Ghost Image, yes. Part of the collection of the, it's a collection of various brief texts, and part of them are about the experience of the photographer, so it's his one. At he settles about the stagings, the phantasm. There are three phantasms of photography where he speaks about staging a photography. But what's interesting is that most of the time the texts are about photographs that finally don't exist because technically there had been a problem. So it's the most famous one is the first one, the image of the mother, of course, yes. It was the...
I think to answer to this, there are a few texts that are obviously about his father, who was an amateur photographer who had very expensive cameras. And he, as a sort of Oedipal reaction, wanted to use really cheap cameras. There's a whole text about this. He had also very good cameras. But there's this idea that you find in many, many texts that I've read, I haven't read everything, that, and I was thinking of this other room here, Dick Torchia's installation, because there's this idea that anything, after all, can become a camera. So anything that is a box with some light and lens and so on, and very often a bus, a room, can become a camera. And so from his parents, let's say, bourgeois practice of the family photograph, and this is something that he shares with Barthes, really likes talking about family albums and so on, you know, like l'art moyen that had been described by Passeron and all the sociologists of, you know, this art that is not an art, and so on, that everybody since the Kodak can have in his as an archive of the family. This is something he plays with a lot in his own practice as a very sophisticated and knowledgeable photographer who nevertheless tries to undo the sophistication by having, you know, these cheap cameras and so on. Do you agree
he
with
also,
this?
You know, you think of Warhol, but he also liked the phone booth, the passport photos.
Photomat, and
he has some pieces on the whole idea of the identity card.
Mm.
And I think that around that time there were some interesting exhibitions that were kind of out of Foucault, of the institution of typologizing various, you know, criminal types according to phrenology or personalities that were pathological or hysterical women. It was Didi Uberman. Mm-hmm. And so I think he's kind of, you know this better than I, but from Ghost Images, he's picking up on that whole idea of identity photos.
Mm. And he loved August Sander, for instance.
Yeah.
He wrote a lot on Sander and this attempt at having a sort of general survey of the population. And,
this text about Sander is very, very amazing because he wrote a text in Ghost Image about Sander, and there is an article about Sander in Le Monde. Mm. When you compared
the text, you can see how functions is writing about photography. When he lets him do in ghost image, and when he's working, when it's for the job, and for Sander, that was that's what he says. That's precisely what he says. The article he tried to write was so difficult because Sander is so objective. So the contrary of what he is and what his look on photography is and what his writing is, that he was it was very painful for him to write about this writer, this photographer, sorry, to write about this photographer without betraying his photography, because he wanted to see something else in the faces that Sander had made so much effort to refrain.
Do we know if he was happier, if it was more in love with his photography or with his life? It was more, and it's pressing, or I feel more comfortable with this form of art, photography, or I feel more mentality.
I'd say what he says, it's not the same use, in fact, because photography is what you do with somebody, and writing is what you do alone. So what? Yeah, but for photography, you must be in presence with somebody, and I mean in physical presence. And it's a way to seduce somebody to take a photograph of him. And Gilbert had used this many times, and so it's not it's a way to get closer to people. Photography, writing is not.
But
the
also
same thing.
Objects. People. I mean, he says at one point, whenever I go to a hotel room, the first thing I have to do is photograph the hotel room, everything in it.
Or make love.
Or make
exactly.
love. Exactly. Right.
Yeah. That's the alternative.
I mean, the only other thing is that there's the particular genre of the self-portrait. So, you know, he definitely, that's where these things come together. And he at various points just like, oh, if I seen my father that age, maybe I'd want to seduce him. You know, he's doing the same with himself.
Yeah.
And when he gets very sick, he says on that radio, on that interview, it's been 3 years since I've allowed myself to be photographed. I don't know if that's true, but he says that because he wants, and he keeps comparing before and after. And I think that's interesting. I mean, everybody does that. They look at themselves 10 years ago. You know, but he tries, he says it's a kind of I'm the other. He really is, he harps on the distance that time creates from one's own image, and he scrutinizes it. So there's this way in which the self-portrait or the before and after is something he's very interested in.
And the text was titled Self-Portrait in Ghost Image is about Rembrandt,
yeah.
The painter Rembrandt's self-portraits, because he collected them. So and he says, this is my self-portrait. I'm building my self-portrait by sequencing the self-portrait of another one.
Mm.
But whose purpose was to do the same thing.
Yeah, I think that text, indeed, there's a wonderful text on Rembrandt's self-portraits that shows, it would be, one would have to analyze it at length, the link between the image in his practice, writing about the image, and taking photographs, which correspond to a single necessity. Well, I think it's a little late, so please, thank you, join me. Thank you. And Cécile.